You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. Northwest states were among the most and least accurate when it came to paying out federal food benefits last fiscal year. SPR's Owen Henderson reports.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture Wednesday released SNAP over and under payment data for 2025. Idaho's combined 3.85% payment error rate was the second lowest in the U.S., behind South Dakota. Washington's rate last year was almost a full percentage point higher than a new 6% maximum set in the Big Beautiful Bill. Oregon had the sixth highest error rate in the country, more than 14%. Nationwide, the rate was more than 10.5%. Previously, the federal government paid for all food benefits and half SNAP's administrative costs. Starting in October 2027, states that go over the threshold will have to chip in for the food benefits. The higher the error rate, the more the state will have to pay. I'm Owen Henderson, reporting.
Washington State's budget has a hole in it, a big one, nearly $500 million. State government reporter Sarah Mises-Tan has more.
State officials are blaming lower-than-expected job and wage growth, along with the impact from the ongoing war in Iran. But they say things could have been worse. The state's capital gains tax brought in more money than expected. This is a tax-the-rich measure that takes a cut off large sales of stocks and bonds.
It doesn't solve, longer-term budget shortfalls. And if you took that out, the forecast is generally down.
That's lead budget writer Senator June Robinson. Governor Bob Ferguson says he won't plug this budget hole by raising new taxes. More revenue forecasts are due in September and November and will show a fuller picture of the state's finances ahead of 2027. In Olympia, I'm Sarah Mises-Tan.
A new study from local researchers looks at the presence of different orca populations in Washington waters from 1978 to 2022. It finds that transient, or Biggs killer whales, are spending more time in Puget Sound. That means they're sharing space with endangered southern residents in local waters more than they're used to. Lead author Zoe Rand is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Washington.
Transients actually eat the marine mammals that eat salmon, so that actually could be good for the southern residents because that then gives them more salmon to eat.
The authors also found southern resident K and L pods are spending less time in the Puget Sound. Rand says this shows the southern residents may need more protections in coastal waters. California, Quebec, and Washington State have merged their markets for carbon pollution. The three governments say it will make their work to fight climate change more effective. KUOW's John Ryan reports.
Each region lets major polluters choose. They can stop harming the climate, or they can pay to keep doing it. Polluters can buy and sell permits to emit heat-trapping carbon dioxide. With an agreement signed Thursday, emitters would be able to buy carbon allowances from anywhere in the three jurisdictions. At the latest auctions in California, pollution permits sold for half the price they did in Washington. Governor Bob Ferguson and supporters stopped short of promising reduced energy prices, but say the combined market would be more stable. The Trump administration, while overseeing the world's largest economy, has been aggressively boosting fossil fuel use. Ferguson says the region can't wait for the federal government to get with the program. California, Quebec, and Washington together are equivalent to the world's fourth largest economy. I'm John Ryan reporting.
This weekend, thousands of basketball players of all sizes and abilities are competing in a hoop fest. Some prepared for the tournament by participating in a basketball camp that targeted a particular demographic. Doug Nadvornik from Spokane Public Radio talks with the camp's director.
For years, Washington State University Spokane has sponsored its two-week Nahashni summer camp for Native American students. It teaches kids what it's like to work as a doctor or nurse or other health professional, especially in a Native community. But attendance was spotty, so Jerry Crowshoe and his team thought there must be a better way to get more kids interested. Crowshoe is the director of WSU's Native American Health Sciences program. The answer was basketball.
Since basketball is pretty popular in Spokane with Hoop Fest and Gonzaga, all the different AAU teams and stuff, State B, we're using basketball, the trend, especially how popular it is in Indian country to provide a camp free for families, because we know how camps can be expensive, where we combine health science teachings and basketball so that way they get a little exposure of both. But also the health sciences contribute to the basketball itself, like doctors teach about, you know, anatomy and muscle building, nursing teaches about injury prevention, you know, speech and hearing about brain trauma, pharmacy about how, you know, good uses and bad uses of Tylenol and, you know, correct ways and proper ways to, you know, to do those, vitamins and stuff. So every college is contributing to the intellectual component of basketball, you know, educating their minds. And then the afternoon we'll go over to Shaw Middle School with our partnership with Spokane Public Schools and do the basketball portion, where we have awesome coaches that'll teach them for the afternoon about, you know, dribbling and basketball and shooting and all that.
They include Jude Schimmel, a Umatilla tribal member from Oregon who played at the University of Louisville and professionally in Spain.
So obviously your timing with HoopFest 3 days away was planned and all of that. I'm guessing a lot of your kids are going to be playing in the tournament.
Yeah, so I asked that question this morning. I you know, when they were all doing orientation, I said, you know, how many of you guys are playing HoopFest? And majority of them all raised their hands, you know. And that was kind of the pitch when we started, was like, you know, we wanted to capitalize on the big HoopFest week. You know, because even my kid who plays basketball, he kind of is done with basketball after HoopFest. You know, he doesn't really start up till fall. So we thought, well, we better do it in June before then. But we also kind of thought it was good to do our part to kind of contribute to, you know, that basketball aura that Spokane has and do our part. And we had to turn kids away just because of the capacity that we were at with chaperones and funding and stuff. You know, with Nahash, you get like 20 kids, you know, for a couple of weeks. We had over 90, probably could well had well over 100 if we kept registration open.
Kroshu says WSU is morphing Nahashni from a single summer camp into a full program that includes separate events for students of different ages.
We work with a tribal advisory board that's made up of tribal elders, tribal leaders. We work with tribes all around our area, and one of the things that they've always been consistent in asking is working younger and younger with their students. You know, like they say, you're matriculating way too late. We said, well, how early should we start working with them? They said kindergarten, and be consistent, you know. So finding ways to expose them to health sciences, you know, is really important, because there's a big need for doctors and nurses in tribal communities.
And with the success of the Many Medicines basketball camp fresh on their minds, Kroshu and his team are considering other camps with sporting themes.
So doing volleyball camps in Yakima, you know, we'd love to do these camps in Nez Perce. We'd love to do these camps in Umatilla. And rather than try to bring kids in, we want to take this camp and these messages out to communities.
Kroshu says those would supplement other new developments in WSU's program, including the opening of a new Indigenous Simulation Center this fall. I'm Doug Nadvornik reporting.
You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Now moving to news from Oregon. Here's KMUN intern Blake Miller.
A dead invasive quagga mussel was found on the shoreline of Prineville Reservoir in central Oregon. As OPB's Alejandro Figueroa reports, this is the first time the freshwater mussel has been spotted near a body of water in the state.
The quagga mussel is about the size of a thumbnail with brown and tan stripes. State monitoring crews found just one in early June. So far, they have not found any more on Prineville Reservoir, and test results from water samples have shown no signs of invasive mussel larvae. Adam Baylor is with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. He says this is a serious economic and ecological concern. It can clog up irrigation pipes and damage hydroelectric infrastructure.
And then for the environment, it can actually change the chemistry of the water and make it inhospitable for certain fish. And it can outcompete our native mussels.
There are no plans to close or quarantine Prineville Reservoir, but crews will continue to monitor and test the water there through the summer. Alejandro Figueroa reporting.
Oregon's new pre-professional women's soccer team played its final home game of the short season yesterday. Kyra Buckley reports.
The Cherry Bombs roster is made up of 21 amateur players. The team is making its debut in the pre-professional USLW Soccer League. Team officials say they wanted to create an opportunity for both fans and players to connect to Portland culture. The vibes are similar to a festival with a punk rock cherry mascot wandering around. But goalkeeper Emma Cameron says,
soccer is always serious.
Her teammate forward Alua Thomason Aludapo says fans should come to the final game for the soccer, but stay for the chants and singing from the Portland Opera.
I love the opera. Cherry bomb, cherry bomb, cherry bomb. So cool. Cherry bomb, 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 bomb.
I'm Kyra Buckley reporting.
Oregon's mattress recycling program is celebrating 1 year of keeping mattresses out of landfills with its no-cost collection sites. KLCC's Hannah Bush reports.
Since the Mattress Stewardship Act went into effect in 2025, the Mattress Recycling Council has teamed up with partners like St. Vincent de Paul to recycle 130,000 mattresses in Oregon. The Mattress Recycling Council's Chief Operating Officer, Mike O'Donnell, says it's amazing to think about that many mattresses.
It stretched end to end. They would go from Eugene all the way to Medford. And if you stack them on top of each other, it would be like 10 Mount Hoods.
By taking apart the mattresses, they can recycle up to 75% of its components. Steel springs, wood frames, foam, and fabric can all be recycled or made into new products. Mattresses can be dropped off at any St. Vincent de Paul location for free, or for a fee, they offer a pickup service. This is Hannah Bush reporting.
Drones are playing a major part in modern warfare, and that includes waterborne drones that swim or float instead of fly. One of them came to the aid of a U.S. Army helicopter that crashed near the Strait of Hormuz June 8th. As Steve Walsh reports for the American Homefront Project, the Pentagon plans to spend billions developing and deploying unmanned sea vessels.
The crew of a downed Army Apache helicopter was rescued by a Navy waterborne drone off the coast of Oman. It's the first time an unmanned vessel has been used to rescue troops, says Brian Clark, who works on Navy policy at the Hudson Institute.
It's faster than waiting for the search and rescue helicopter to come out and find you. And they were able to basically take that unmanned vehicle and get them to a safer spot. And then the helicopter could pick them up and take them home.
Clark says the Navy has been using this type of drone mainly for surveillance since the start of the war with Iran. Built by a Texas company, Saronic, they're 24 feet long and look a bit like a small fishing boat without seats. He says the Navy has been funding prototypes for years, even as it focused most of its resources on large warships.
Until maybe 2 years ago, I questioned the Navy's commitment because there just wasn't that much money going into them. And they'd done a lot of experimentation and prototypes and demonstrations, and they really hadn't translated that into vehicles that were being bought at any scale.
Then in late 2023, Houthi rebels used both air and water-based drones against the U.S. in the Red Sea. The defense budget now includes billions for acquisition. To speed up the process, the Navy is setting up a marketplace for companies to sell their drones directly to the military and other potential federal buyers after the Navy approves their designs. Fairlead is a shipbuilder and repair company in Portsmouth, Virginia. They've focused most of their efforts into building components for big Navy warships. Fred Pasquin shows off sections of the flight deck of the future USS Enterprise, which are being welded at one of their shops.
This is more of the panel getting assembled, and there's a little over 1,000 of these that make up an aircraft here.
Fairlead is also building parts for a Columbia-class submarine. Business is booming, but with the Navy's emphasis on drones, the company is trying to get into the new marketplace. They are working with the defense contractor Sierra Nevada Corp to build drones that will be roughly 50 feet long. Fairlead Vice President Todd Babcock says the Navy wants companies that can produce a lot of vessels quickly.
Can they build them? Can they scale? Can they do it quickly? Those that can do that will play out favorably. I think it all comes down to, are you a boutique provider? Or are you really a legitimate contender in the unmanned market?
The Navy is looking for designs that can do things like locate mines, interfere with incoming fire, or essentially be waterborne guided missiles. Many are small enough to be loaded onto containers and sent on Navy ships. The Marines are interested in an unmanned boat that can deliver supplies to the beach under fire, Clark says. Large shipbuilders have limited capacity. They strain to deliver carriers and submarines on time. But he says capacity isn't an issue for the smaller drone market.
The U.S. is the largest boat building industry in the world, and that's a great opportunity. If you can go to these boat builders when you need a bunch of vessels built and build them, and then those builders can go back to building commercial vessels when they're done.
The Navy is testing prototypes for the first 7 bidders and hopes to have a list of winners by September. If that goes well, Clark says other companies like Fairlead will get a chance to compete for the Navy's business. In Norfolk, Virginia, I'm Steve Walsh.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration on American military life and veterans. With the 4th of July holiday this weekend, tourism officials say Pacific County's population could temporarily swell to nearly 100,000 people. Josh Phillips, the executive director of the Pacific County Tourism Bureau, estimates visitation to the Long Beach Peninsula in particular could draw larger crowds than in years past amid festivities to celebrate America's 250th birthday. The Long Beach Police Department will bring in extra officers for the weekend. State parks say they plan to have additional rangers on duty at the coast where campgrounds are already full. Rain appears unlikely to dampen the celebrations, with a current forecast for a high of 65 and no precipitation. Dumpsters will be available at beach approaches for people to discard their trash and extinguished fireworks. If dumpsters become full, State Parks is asking that people pack out their trash rather than leave it nearby or overfill the dumpster. The Washington Coast Savers Beach Cleanup is July 5th at 9 a.m. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. Wheeler City Council has approved a controversial 24-room hotel and restaurant. The Planning Commission originally approved the project as a part of a multi-phase development to boost the local economy and increase transient lodging tax revenues. Commissioners had debated whether the project exceeded the 10-unit limit in the city's vision plan. But given its location away from the residential area of the city, the Planning Commission agreed that the project was in compliance with the city's mission of preserving natural beauty. The Oregon Coast Alliance appealed the decision to City Council. At a subsequent public hearing, the council was tasked to uphold or reverse the Planning Commission's decision. Ultimately, city leadership agreed that the city's need for economic growth outweighed the concerns for protecting the city's small-town feel. But they did add two more conditions to ensure the project does not cause environmental harm. For the project to move forward now, a portion of the property must still be annexed to the city, a process that is expected to begin in August in front of the Planning Commission. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. Hammond's historic downtown district is getting a makeover. The city of Warrenton has hired a company specializing in public financing to create an urban renewal district in Hammond, intended to combat blight and spur economic growth. The company, Tiberius Solutions, will analyze the existing urban renewal district in Warrenton and will assist the city in setting up the district, all while assuring those who live there will be involved in the planning process. Revenue raised within the Warrenton Urban Renewal District, which is sunsetting in a year, was spent to improve public infrastructure. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Columbia Press. Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Attorneys general from 23 states challenged President Donald Trump's March 31st executive order on elections under the Elections Clause of the U.S. Constitution. June 25th, a federal district court judge blocked the administration and the U.S. Postal Service from implementing key sections of the order. It's the latest decision confirming that states and Congress have oversight of elections and, quote, the Constitution does not grant the president any specific powers over elections. The judge enjoined the administration from implementing sections 2 and 3 of the executive order. Judge Indira Tolwani of the Massachusetts Federal District Court barred the administration from demanding of states or creating a state citizenship list and pointed to writings of the founders and court precedent that states controlled the eligibility of voters, not the executive branch. Trump's executive order tasked USPS with verifying eligibility of voters receiving or returning mail-in ballots using the state citizenship list. However, the judge wrote, no law enacted by Congress delegates authority to control mail-in voting to USPS. The ruling follows a June 22nd D.C. federal court order barring integration of data into the related SAVE database from federal agencies as a violation of federal privacy statutes. We've linked both decisions at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
You're listening to KMUN.